Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, November 29th, 2012. And I've lost my voice here. I hope you can recognize it in this froggy voice. this is my voice. But I don't know what happened yesterday. I was outside and unfortunately ended up talking like this. The wind, I don't know what affected me. But anyway, tonight I want to talk a little bit about the electrical nature of comets, actually responding to some interesting NASA issues. NASA is doing some very big damage control on this comet C2012S1, and it's very subtle. It's very subtle. So I'll try and explain that a little bit here. And then also I want to talk about Egypt to start out with. The Egypt writing right now for the second time in a very short period of time, rewriting a constitution, throwing out their government and struggling to be free. So, but see, every time this happens, with any country, let's put it, the bankers get in there and try and muscle their way through and become come out on top at the end. And the American Revolution, as it is called, the United States, the first 13 colonies, did the same thing. The entire Constitution, the entire reason, was to get rid of the banks. And of course there was Hamilton, who tried to keep the bankers in there. He was their man in Washington at the time. Of course it wasn't called Washington at the time, but Philadelphia, where all of this took place. But Egypt trying desperately to get rid of the international bankers, in the process right now of writing or rewriting a constitution. So anyway, that's something that we should all follow. But when you do this, please understand that the real reason for this, and a lot of these people don't understand the full ramifications of everything going on, but they do know, they know that, and this is in the public now, mind you, as opposed to the U.S., where the public here is still living in the U.S. Disneyland or whatever syndrome, where everything is good and the election. I just wanted to comment here on this vein, how stupid Americans are in general. I have the fortune of having an amazingly intelligent, very astute audience following my show, and so that's wonderful. There's a small percentage of people who understand how the world spins, but at any rate, looking at along this vein of how stupid Americans are, I wanted to read some headlines, and one of the worst places to get headlines, or the most constructed places, is CNN. I call it the candy nugget news. But anyway, given what's going on in the world today, here are the top headlines. They're still chattering about Romney versus Obama, as if that isn't a dead story. They're talking about the jobless rate, which is absurd to talk about in the economy. I mean, there's no real news that they present there. They're talking about some NFL player getting a $30,000 fine. Here's Lindsay Lohan arrested again, and Lady Gaga tweets Lindsay Lohan. This is the news on CNN. I mean, my goodness, something. Here's one. A man gets surgery for mustaches, $7. A cup of coffee causes a stir. Loud music complaint. You know, this is the news of today. And you go, my goodness, this is so absurd. This is so beyond absurd. But that's what they're presenting with the news today, for news in the United States. But the austerity programs around the world continue. The populations of Europe struggling with this, they are certainly under the thumb of the international bankers. And the point is that these austerity programs will be coming very soon to a neighborhood near you in the good old USA. It's just that they can color the news so well in the United States that you don't see the real numbers, the number of people who have lost homes, the concept of families losing their homes due to what they call an economic downturn is so beyond absurd. The fact that people accept this, a good indicator right now, prior to Christmas, Best Buy, the biggest electronic retailer in the country, is having serious problems. This is a time when they should be booming. This should be a time when they're having record sales. But no, Best Buy tanking. Why is that? People don't have any money. They don't have any money to go to Best Buy and buy new computers and for little Johnny or little games or video, whatever. You know, people don't have money for this. They're struggling to make a house payment. So at any rate, that's to me, and I believe this time last year I made an announcement about Best Buy. They were having trouble then. Now they're really, really having trouble. And how they're floating that boat is anybody's question, but the point is that right now, after Black Friday or whatever they call it, the day after Thanksgiving, apparently, according to reports anyway, the Black Friday date was actually a success, that a lot of people purchased, went out and bought things. But from what I understand, people were paying like 25 cents on the dollar for things. People were going for the deals. I heard all kinds of people say, oh, I bought this. It was, 30% of cost. And so that was what was going on Black Friday. And, of course, the retailers say, well, that was great because why? They cleared their shelves of inventory and got cash. So that was something that they're going to try. But if the reality is as they move into the new year, these companies, retailers especially, are going to be cash poor. And they'll start dropping like flies at that point. You're going to start to see the doors closing. First, you'll see the remarkable sales, the things going on sale. And then you'll see the doors closing. It'll be very obvious that the U.S. is in a severe recession, and of course the news won't cover it. The news media will be talking about Lindsay Lohan and Lady Gaga tweeting Lindsay Lohan. That's what you're going to be getting for news as this country crumbles and falls. Okay, on to the main science topic. By the way, I believe the corn has finally sold out. I think that report came in, and what happened there is we had a little bit left, and there was kind of a run on it in the fall, and then I said it was all sold out. So I think people turned their interest to other things, and then I said, oops, well, we've got a little bit more we're going to sell off, and just after all the shipping was done. So, but I think it is finally sold out. But at any rate, the thing I want to concentrate on products is I am surprised, but I'm not surprised that a couple things on my website are showing that people are showing interest in at long last. Not that they weren't initially, but the two things that people are really showing an interest in are the pre-filter. It's a housing that sits on top of your regular gravity feed filter. Fits any of them that exist in the market today, except the little teeny ones. I'm talking about the standard kitchen size or emergency size water filters, stainless steel or plastic. This sits on top Then there's you layer in a series of powders, and depending on what pollution you have in your water, and this pre-filters the water, and it's very important because if you have sludge, oil, radiation, whatever is in your water, minerals, a lot of times people have, even without emergency, some people have very heavy mineral in their water, and they gum up their water filter very quickly. There's a lot of people who are using the pre-filter on a daily basis. It's not just for emergency because their water is so bad. It's well water or whatever. Anyway, the whole idea of the pre-filter is that the powders are relatively inexpensive, and they last a long time, but you dispose of them, you just throw them out. They are food and medical grade powders, so they're perfect for the purpose of pre-filtering. And then you just, when they get gummed up and full, you throw them out and put new powder in. It's a really great invention, and my webpage is the only place in the universe that has these pre-filters. It's called the Chem Rad Oil Pre-Filter, and that's what it takes out: chemicals, radiation, the dust that radiation hangs onto, and oil. It'll absorb oil. If you have oil in your water, get that out of there. Don't put it into your nice clean water filter. So anyway, that's the pre-filter. People are taking note of that. I would suggest, here's another thing, that the capacity to supply these items is limited. Here's the biggest point, that we're not going to be able to supply everybody out there that ever bought a water filter. As people wake up and realize that if we have emergencies, like I've talked before about the comet C2012S1 and the potential for another Passover type event, I don't know if it's going to happen. I'm not saying 100% that it's going to happen or not. I don't know. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure it's going to happen next fall when, or actually January of 2014 was the date. We don't even know if that comet will be in that orbit at that time. So we don't know a lot of these factors. We don't know if the tail drag on this comet is going to change it into a much different orbit. We don't know if the interaction with Mars is going to change this. But at any rate, if we did have such an event, you would want a pre-filter definitely for your water system. But like I say, there's a limited capacity on manufacturing this particular product, and the demand does seem to be going up. But okay, so that's one item on my webpage. It's unique. The other one is called the Modular Filtration and Storage System. It's 6.5 gallon tanks. These are huge. And it's a water filter. It has a dome filter. It comes with two dome filters, these are high capacity, in other words, that filters that water pretty quickly, 6.5 gallons. And then it comes with three storage containers. These are 6.5 gallons also. And so it's and they have screw-on lids with rubber seals. So it gives you the opportunity to store about 20 gallons total of water in this system. And that's a pretty amazing feat, to have 20 gallons of fresh water. It just blows away any of the competition by leaps and bounds. There's nobody that has anything close to this. And the purpose is to have something to put your water in, sealed containers. If the pollution gets rough, you're going to need water in sealed containers. Then you can open them up and have clean water. You'll be the only guy in your block that does, I guarantee you. So that's the Modular Filtration and Storage System. Okay, enough of that, but I just wanted to toot my horn a little bit about those items. And we're actually at the point where we're keeping up the stock of those, but it's been difficult trying to keep ahead of orders. now, especially in this pre-Christmas time where we're trying to make sure everybody gets everything, especially before Christmas, because a lot of these turn out to be gifts. You can order on the webpage and have it shipped to any place in the world. Just put the person's name and address in the ship to it section of the order, and we'll ship it to them based on your order. Okay, so enough of that. But just a little bit about tomorrow night, Friday night, will be a part four in of the History Channel special, Countdown to Apocalypse. And I'll be featured in that. I'll be talking about Planet X. And you have to understand, remember, it's History Channel 2. Look for Countdown to Apocalypse. It's not the main History Channel. It's History Channel and then the number 2. And then Countdown to Apocalypse, Friday night. Look for the listings. I don't know what time it's on in your area, so you have to look for your local listings. If you have cable or whatever it comes on, whatever medium, satellite or whatever type of television you have to look at your local listing for when you'll be able to see that. But anyway, I'm featured on that one. I'll be talking about Planet X. And just to give you a perspective here, I'm in all six parts of the series. It's a six-part series. And I'm the only person that's in more than one section. So they really liked what I did. I know I talked with the editors and the producers, and they were very much liked what I did. But they tried to give balanced accounting to other people who were contributing. But this one is based on the topic is Legends of the Hopi. And so when I did the interview, we did about 3.5 hours of filming. And what you're going to see here is, of course, very edited. And, you know, they had limited amount. And I didn't have a lot of say on the animation that went along with what I was talking about. So I know I've gotten feedback from other people who've watched so far and seen little bits and pieces of me saying something in the prior shows, in the first three shows. And they all, you know, these are people that understand me, my work, my history, and what I talk about. So they understand that this is mixed in with a lot of other people and other people's ideas. But it gets my message out to the public, which is something that is very much needed. And it draws attention to my work, and then with that, people can go to my webpage and start getting that real education, so to speak. So at any rate, Friday night, tomorrow night, History Channel 2, Countdown to Apocalypse, and I'm at the very end. I think I've got about the last 10 or 15 minutes of that show talking about Planet X. So at any rate, as I say, edited out of 3.5 hours of filming and down to like 10 minutes, so you can imagine that there's a lot that I talked about, a lot, which never got in there. But at any rate, check it out. Then also, I've been doing a lot of radio lately, just to name a few people who I've been on their show, John Moore. And I missed this Wednesday. Every Wednesday morning I'm on with John Moore at, I think it's 6 o'clock now, Central Time, every Wednesday morning. And I'm going to try and keep that schedule, although winter might get a little difficult here. And then Dr. Bill Deagle, I talk with him every Wednesday also in the afternoon. I think it's 4 o'clock Central Time for that. And then Andrew Russ, I've been on with him on Friday afternoons. And then Dan Johns, the Sunday morning version of his show. I think he's got a Wednesday evening, but I'm on the Sunday morning. I've been a few times a guest there recently. But at any rate, just doing some more radio interviews with a broad spectrum of other talk show hosts to just get the word out there about the things that I'm working on. James Jancic has started his show again, and I'm going to be a guest there, probably not on a regular basis, but we'll have to see. His show called Feet to Fire. And he went off the air for a while, but he's back again. Okay, on to the main science topic. Now, you all know that I've been talking recently quite extensively about a comet, C2012S1. And this comet has the potential to really cause a lot of damage, let's say, to NASA and their image of the dirty snowball, the little fluffy comet that floats through space and just melts a little bit when it gets near the sun. It's such an absurd idea. I mean, this is Mickey Mouse science at its worst, or at its best. I don't know what to say there. But it's a concept that cannot explain any of the real aspects of cometary activity. And let's take one example. In 1979, when I was doing my printing of the first book that came out, that was the published work, I was at Cornell, and oddly enough, Carl Sagan's secretary was the one doing my typing on my book. Marie Jones was her name. I don't know if she's still alive. If Maria's out there, I hope she's doing well. But anyway, she did a lot of typing. She was a secretary in the space science department at Cornell University. And typed my book, and that's when you used a real typewriter, and you did the whiteout and the overtyping, and every page had to be retyped. You know, there was no automatic retyping of a page. We modified that book into some more palatable forms, taking a few in terms of publishing, and that's where my papers. When I was in the mathematics department, Marie typed the papers that were published in astrophysics journals. And one of them was called Continuing Galactic Evolution, and it was the gravitational collapse concept of galactic evolution. And there was another one called Saturn's Sweeper Moons Predicted. Saturn's Sweeper Moons Predicted. And the topic of that paper was dealing with the moons of Saturn. I predicted that there would be moons in the gaps in Saturn's rings, and that they would sweep out the bands that we see in Saturn's rings. And, of course, all of those moons were discovered. And, of course, a guy named Joe Burns, NASA space scientist, stole my ideas, stole the terms, published the papers, and became famous for... a person in Standard Science that talked about moons in the gaps in Saturn's rings, but he even called them sweeper moons. But here's the point. When I originally went to publish that paper, I submitted it to Icarus, which was the space science journal of Cornell. That's, they have their own space science journal called Icarus. I submitted it there. And typically, Carl Sagan would have been the editor-in-chief, but he was gone becoming a movie star making the Cosmos series. So a guy named Joe Burns was acting editor of Icarus at that time. And so Joe reviewed the paper, and I still have the letter where Joe says, no, this is not an idea that's palatable. We know that these rings formed 4.5 billion years ago before the... you know, at the formation of the solar system, and your idea is stupid, basically. He rejected my paper from publication. Then after the moons were discovered, Joe, the thief, Joe Burns from Cornell University Space Science Department, stole my idea, published it, and became the world-renowned expert on the sweeper moons of Saturn. This is just a little history here of what happened. That's the kind of activity. That's what started opening my eyes to the reality of space science and astronomy. And, of course, they were instrumental. I'm sure Joe had his hand in there when they were trying to get rid of me at... both the physics and then that later when I was teaching in the math department, they got a hold of the chairman of the math department, Wolfgang Fuchs, And Wolfgang called me into his office one day in the math department. I was teaching calculus at Cornell. And he said, you know, I'm not sure what to do here. You're doing really well. The students love you. And I just got a petition. He had just received a petition from 350 students in my calculus class that I had taken over for another professor who was on leave. And he said, they want you to continue teaching their calculus class. I had this petition on his desk with 350 student names on it. And he says, I don't know what to do. He says, your teaching is good. He said, you are the, he had my other published papers on his desk, including the Saturn sweeper moons, which I then resubmitted to a European journal. And it was published in the Moon and the Planets was the name of that journal at the time. That the name of that journal has since changed a little bit. But that was a journal out of the Netherlands, and I got it published there based on a recommendation of a guy named Hans Bethe, who I used to go and visit at Cornell. Hans Bethe, of course, was a buddy of Albert Einstein. Hans Bethe being a also Nobel Prize winner for his work on the chemistry, the nuclear chemistry of stars. But when I was talking to Hans one day, I said, you know, I'm having trouble now publishing my stuff in the American journals here. I've been blackballed. He says, here, try this journal in the Netherlands. And so I sent that particular paper to the Moon and the Planets, and lo and behold, it got published there. And so that's one of my initial published papers in peer-reviewed astrophysics and space science journals. But the point is that I was talking, Wolfgang Fuchs, and the chairman of the math department called me in, and he says, I don't know what to do. He says, your teaching is good, the students love you, I have this petition, 350 students want me to give you the position next year to teach and continue teaching their calculus class. And you're the only person, in the faculty, in the history of Cornell University, in the math department faculty, to ever publish a paper in the peer-reviewed astrophysics and space science journals. And you haven't just published one, you've published multiple articles. And he says, I don't know what to do. The space science department and astronomy department are basically pressuring me to get rid of you. He says, I don't know what to do. He says, I'll have to make a decision, and I'll let you know by an intercampus mail. So I got my response, and basically I was not renewed, as it is called. And that was the timing there was I had worked in the physics department in the first semester 1979 until they discovered that I was publishing papers on the electric comet theory, I called it plasma discharge comet model. And of course that was immediately slammed down by the astronomy department at Cornell. And they talked to a guy named Doug Fitchin, who was the chairman of the physics department at the time. And I went into Doug's office one day. He called me in. He was extremely angry, and he had my papers on his desk about comets, the original electric universe, electric comet ideas. And he said, you can't publish this here. You can't use Cornell's name anymore. And he said, I got a little bit of a problem here because you're teaching a class, and I don't have anybody to teach your class. But you cannot talk to the students about any of this, and you're going to finish out your semester here. And the reason they liked me, because I was bilingual. I could interact with the students. They needed bilingual teachers because of the student population at Cornell. He said, okay, and they had a woman. Her name was Betty Robinson. That was her name. She was a doctor there, and her job was to follow me around. She was kind of an administrative PhD. I don't know what her real role was there, but Doug Fitchin assigned her, and every time I was in the classroom, Betty was there. shadowing me. She would sit there, she would listen, and her job was to report back and make sure I did not talk about any of my scientific discoveries or work or publications or whatever to any of the students. Just a little history there. So there's a lot of people out there not familiar with some of these. People have said I should write a book on all of the incidents like this that happened. But at any rate, at the end of that first semester at Cornell, I was not renewed, and at that time I had established a rapport with the mathematics department. And so I walked across campus and got rehired by the mathematics department. And I found out that I think I was the only person also who had worked in both the physics and the math department. So I worked for another year and a half in the math department, primarily undergraduate calculus. And so at any rate, and prior to that, just to let you know, I had been out of the United States for many years teaching at the university level. And so that's where I was bilingual. I taught in a foreign language. I taught just about all the math courses from basic intro math all the way up to advanced analysis at the university level in a foreign country. And so when I got to Cornell in early 1979, they liked me because I was bilingual, I'd been teaching, I had a good teaching record, etc. So at any rate, spending a total of 2 years at Cornell, but that was during the time when the spacecraft data was coming in from the Voyagers, from the Pioneer spacecraft, from they had probes going out to Venus, and daily, I mean, it was literally daily, every day you could go to one or two or three different symposiums that were held within the university. A lot of NASA scientists there at Cornell, either teaching graduate level, a single course, or just doing research as a member of the research faculty at Cornell. And so they were all around at the time. And so these were daily meetings, and the data would come in, and people would sit there and throw out ideas. And I called it hip pocket theorizing. It was kind of like shooting a gun from the hip. An idea would come in, some observation, and some guy would say, well, I think an asteroid hit it, and that's what happened. You know, and, oh, okay, well, and that would become published in Nature or Science magazine. And then that became the standard, and it never changed. And I thought, this is pretty strange. I saw this, you know, this hip pocket, shooting from the hip theorization going on. The next thing you know, it's published in Science magazine or Nature. Those were the two big outlets. And all of a sudden, it's the gospel truth, and no more discussion on it. And this is how science was being done. So it was like the NASA scientists could do no wrong, but they all had to be, basic. The solar system started 4.5 billion years ago, so I at that time I created the name called Axioms of Astronomy. It's something that I've carried through to my later publications, the ones that you see now. Axioms of Astronomy, and that term came from an editor of an English journal that wrote me a letter when I was writing about dirty snowball comet models, that they couldn't possibly be that, and here are all the observations that show that comets could not be dirty snowballs. And then he would pass the Zedek he would pass on to other editors. And they would write back and say, oh, no, it's understood that comets are dirty snowball. That cannot be questioned. And so he wrote to me, and he says, I'm not sure what's going on here, but he says it seems like these, like the dirty snowball comet model, is an axiom of astronomy. It's not a theory anymore. It's an axiom. It's a starting point that you have to use, just like an axiom of mathematics. So I picked up that term, and Zdeněk Koupala is the guy's name, with a K, was the editor, and he was basically Eastern Bloc scientists working in England at the time. But the point was that these axioms, and so I said there's basically four axioms out there of astronomy, and they have to be used or your papers simply will not be published. And I did it, of course, tongue-in-cheek, with sarcasm, so to speak. The four axioms of astronomy, that the universe or the solar system began 4.5 billion years ago, and nothing has happened since. No new planets, no new structure in the solar system. And of course, that's false, as can be. The other one was that comets were dirty snowballs. That was one of the axioms of astronomy. And of course, that's not, that's just absurd. The level of absurdity there is just beyond belief. I said that another axiom was the Big Bang, that the universe began in a Big Bang, and that for all formation of matter and everything we see came out of that. And then the fourth axiom that I talked about was that the universe was electrically neutral. And, of course, that isn't true. And so none of the four axioms of astronomy that I defined could possibly be true, but all papers that are published in the respected, so-called respected, peer-reviewed space science, astronomy, or astrophysics journals had to comply with those axioms or they didn't get published. And so, at any rate, a little history there also on where that term came from. And the people, especially the older scientists, were being forced out by the young, very aggressive, boisterous space scientists that were hired at NASA. And very big egos, very, very big egos. Joe Vavirka, some of the old boys there at Cornell, egos beyond their beyond boundaries. And a lot of them, unfortunately, sticking to those old archaic theories today. And that's why when people get PhDs today, they learn these archaic, outdated theories, and so you have all the PhDs standing in a row saying the same thing. The rows and columns of PhDs saying the same thing does not make science. It's simply a mutual admiration society in which they can continue their monopoly of science, especially space science, space geology, astronomy, and astrophysics, because they're in power. They get the federal funding, they publish the papers, they're on the peer review committees, and life goes on, and it's not going to change. So there's no point in talking to those people. That's why this show is very good, because I have a lot of scientists who listen to this show every week, and I have a lot of immense population of everybody out there, from little kids to moms and dads to grandmas to truck drivers to in addition to just to the scientists, because this brings you real information on how the weather works, etc. But let me talk a little bit about NASA doing damage control regarding comet C2012S1. This comet, and now remember that all of the orbital data, the predictions of where this comet will be, all of that orbital data I get from NASA. Now they're saying that this is on a 1.2 million year orbit. And before, they were trying to say that this was the comet of 1680. Well, if it's on a 1.2 million year orbit, then it's not the comet of 1680, is it? Because that's only a couple hundred years back. So it certainly could not be that same comet. But it's on a very similar orbit, coming in from the same place out in outer space. But this is exactly the kind of thing that I was talking about. 1.2 million years ago, this comet was once again in the solar system. And if Earth were in a little bit different orbit, a little different position, this comet could have drastically affected Earth, or it could have affected some other planet in the solar system, left some severe marks on that planet and passed through, and maybe did not affect Earth greatly. But this is how the solar system works. There are comets out there, and of course, we don't have any modern record of this comet. There's no history in, say, the Greeks or the Romans or the ancient Egyptians seeing this comet, because it was 1.2 million years ago. It's a perfect example of a planet-sized object that's coming into the solar system. NASA says that the nucleus is 26 miles across, which is enormous. They claimed that Hale-Bopp was 40 miles across. So this is a comet on the scale of Hale-Bopp. But remember that NASA always minimizes the size of the nucleus. Remember that Comet Lovejoy, they estimated to be 600 meters across, the official NASA estimate. And how absurd, because that comet first passed through the solar atmosphere, came out the other side, and you could see the naked nucleus, the planetary-sized nucleus, bigger than Mercury, in the morning sky right off to the sun before it reformed a tail. And so you could actually see the atmosphere of the nucleus, or you could see the nucleus of the comet without the atmosphere. And it was big. It was planet-sized, and NASA continued to say, oh, this is just a little dirty snowball. Yeah, it passes through the solar atmosphere, you know, 6,000-degree atmosphere. It passes through the 6-million-degree solar corona of pure electrons, high-energy relativistic electrons. And it comes out, forms the tail again like nothing happened. In fact, the tail, when it came out on the other side, was bigger than when it went into the sun. So, you know, the dirty snowball comet model is just beyond laughable. It's absurd. So at any rate, but back to D2012S1, apparently this has a 1.2 million year orbit. But there are many comets. Imagine how many big comets are out there like this that are coming into the solar system. And some of them are on their way. Some of them may have been here 10,000 years ago, left, and won't be back for 20,000 years, 50,000, 100,000, 500,000 years. Who knows? They're all over the place. They're comets. And they'll come into the solar system, and we have no warning. We have no history of these. But NASA is out there trying to do damage control, saying that, oh no, these objects will not cause solar flares, they will not cause CMEs, and of course trying to negate everything that I've been talking about. So it's funny, but they're very, very aware of my message to the public. And I bet you some of them are listening right now. And knowing that you're listening, that's what bothers them. That I have an audience out there that you're listening and you're understanding. And see, this is the difference between a NASA scientist and me. The NASA scientist says, oh no, this won't happen, and expects you to believe him because he's got a PhD and a badge and a position at NASA. The people listen to me and I tell them how things work. I tell them how comets work and why you will see certain effects, so the people understand. You're not listening to me just because my name's Jim McCanny or something like that. No, I tell you, you read my books, you read my information, it teaches you how comets work. It's a complete theory. It was developed 30 years ago and longer, but that's when it became publicly available. And the NASA scientists on their web pages are still going, if anybody has anything to print out there, please put it here. And it's, no, I'm not going to put some on their stupid web page blog where they control it and they control and edit it. No, you think I'm going to do that? But here's the funny part, and this is why I'm bringing this up. And this came in from a listener this over the last couple weeks, actually. that the listeners, I understand, my listeners have been posting on certain NASA web pages and putting a link to my page and saying, Jim McCanny says such and such, and they don't allow my name to be mentioned on these web pages. They don't want you, the public, finding out about me and going to my web page. So what has happened, and this was a skillfully set up disinformation program, around the year 2005, a page appeared on the internet claiming that these clowns started the electric universe concept. Well, it's absurd. My papers were published with that term in it in 1979. But what happens? Here's a page that has people that are imposters. One clown claims to be a PhD astrophysicist, and he's got no degree at all. Here's the part that you have to understand. Every day, they get a picture from NASA, and they call it Picture of the Day. And then there's a description. And the pictures are always exactly formatted in the same format, and they're courtesy of NASA. Well, gee, I'd sure love to have somebody at NASA sending me a picture every day that all formatted and all explained on how everything goes. That would sure be neat. But NASA isn't sending me any pictures. Somebody is spending a lot of resources at NASA to support this page. And here's why. Because when something like Comet C2012S1 comes in, then NASA has their punching bag. Okay, and it's a bunch of fluff and air. There's nothing there. There's no theoretical work. It's just all air. It's a bunch of people that run around, jump up and down, and they have collected a series of buzz terms. They put them together like a monkey punching keys on a keyboard, and voila. And then if you can say electric universe, then everything's supposed to magically come true, like you're at the Magic Kingdom at Disney World. And that's not how the electrical concepts work. You have to understand them. They're complex and they're subtle. But at any rate, the point is that they have this constant dialogue with this group, and of course, NASA always wins, which they should, because they're dealing with a bunch of clowns. But that's the dog and pony show that goes on. And as I said, my listeners have posted, you know, go listen to Jim McCanny. He's talking about the details of Comet C2012S1, and you know, here's the situation. The point is that they've set up this dog and pony show so that NASA has its bad guy over there, and isn't it interesting that the bad guy gets support from NASA? It wouldn't even exist if it weren't for NASA. They wouldn't have anything to post on their page if it weren't for NASA. So they set up this little dog and pony show, but don't ever let them use my name on that webpage. Anyway, that's but the point is, the whole point of this is that NASA is doing serious, serious damage control right now, trying to prevent the public from talking about the real or seeing the real issues with this comet, and I have pointed them out. January 15th, we may see some serious weather here on Earth as Earth itself aligns with this comet. 2 days ago, we had an alignment with Little Mercury, but there again, that comet is still out by the orbit of Jupiter, not something we're going to see a lot of activity here on Earth. The comet is still very small relative to observing, although it is growing in size. But starting next September, all of this could change when that comet starts to come close to Mars, and boy, did they ever not mention that. They do not want you, the public, knowing that. So make sure you write big capital letters on your calendar next September, mid-September, when this comet starts to approach Mars, it starts to become naked eye visible, and hopefully we're going to start to see some electrical interactions, visible electrical interactions between this comet and Mars. And we could see some terraforming events. We could see some change in the orbit of the comet, we could possibly see, if this comet is big enough, we could potentially see a change in the orbit of Mars. That's when we'll know exactly how big the nucleus of this comet is, to see the interaction, the gravitational interaction between Mars and this comet. So stay tuned for that. But as I said, NASA is just already seriously starting its damage control on this comet. And then as it works its way into the solar system, we could be in for a real light show. And especially now, if the comet orbit does not change and the predicted path does not change due to tail drag, remember that that's another factor. This comet could plunge deeper into the sun than expected, slow down a lot more, and it could whip around and change orbits and be on an orbit that comes much closer to Earth. But even if it doesn't, even if it stays on the orbit that we're seeing right now, it could it'll very definitely put on a pretty good light show. And that's where people all over the world are going to look up, and NASA's credibility is going to be on the line. And the people are just going to go, this ain't no little snowball, boys. That, you know, coming out of the sun, forming this big comet. And the ancients talk about the comets with many tails. Venus had up to 7 tails, it was said. And the way this happens is the comets, especially when they're moving quickly around the sun, and we saw it with Comet Lovejoy, they will pull in a comet tail, and it's coming in, and then the comet moves so quickly that it leaves the tail material, and that tail material then blows out with the solar wind. And so tail disconnection is the typical term, but it ends up forming multiple tails. And when the comet is down below the horizon, it looks like a whole series of comets all lined up and the tails sticking up over the horizon. So we could see this particular effect with this comet. Something else that'll start to draw people's attention as they look up into the morning sky in those early to mid-September next year, as this comet starts to approach Mars. And then it's going to move very quickly. Within a month, it'll move in around the sun and then out again, becoming very visible in the evening and night sky. Up along the night sky, moving out towards Jupiter, and then in January of 2014, it will be very visible in the night sky. So it'll be something. In fact, the projections, and remember, like I say, these projections of orbits and visibility come from NASA, and actually they don't come specifically from NASA. They come through NASA, from the Russian observatory that discovered these. And this is another very interesting point, that the discoverers of this comet are from the same observatory in Russia that discovered Comet Elenin. Now, remember Comet Elenin and all of the hoopla about it? I remember it was a January about, almost 2 years ago, I believe, when the comet Elenin flash started. I was on a radio show as a guest, and a woman called in, and she was obviously disinformation plant. And she said, "What do you think about Comet Elenin? Is it going to really affect Earth?" And I said, at that time, I said, "No, Comet Elenin is a nothing comet. It doesn't have anything going that would affect Earth at all." And then my name started being used on a website out of France called SOTT.net, S-O-T-T.net. And some woman talked to aliens and said the end of the world was coming and Comet Elenin and this. And then they did that for about 2 months, and I tried to get it stopped, so I started going on my own show telling people, hey, there's nothing to this Comet Elenin thing, don't listen to it. But it rose in pitch and leaps and bounds. And then NASA got in, the white horses from NASA rode in and said how ridiculous this was, Discover Magazine, and all of them pointing, and of course my name was in the middle of it, not by any agreement with me, because I don't post on other people's web pages, and I was telling this website, and of course nobody could contact them, my friend James Jancic, had difficult time trying to contact them about this issue of getting my name off of their webpage. And of course, NASA was having a field day pointing to it, and that I was not saying anything like that at all, that Comet Elenin would be a problem. But the point is that now all of those websites are quiet as a church mouse. You would think they would be all over this comet because it has potential to really raise some eyebrows and possibly more. But those web pages are silent as church mouses, which just shows you that they are controlled disinformation websites used in this dog and pony show that goes on with NASA. But the interesting part is that the comet, the announcement of the discovery of this comet, C2012S1, is the same outfit in Russia that announced Comet Elenin. And so I find that very interesting. And then the people that hover around the blogs of those web pages are the same people. So my guess is these people have known about this for a long time, and the announcement finally came out so NASA could control the press. It's as simple as that. But at any rate, next week I'll be back talking more about specifics, and I do have planned charts to be posting on my website all of the different interactions once this comet starts coming in and actually becoming very visible. You will be able to see on my webpage the charts and the diagrams of where to look and what to look for. And I was looking in my history. I had a comet observing event like this, maybe 5-6 years ago. But I'll be reposting that just to show what I had done at that time. I'm just about out of time tonight, so I want to remind you, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and do a little bit of Christmas shopping there, have some items sent to some friends, and this just unique items that you won't find anyplace else. My books are unique there. By the way, do not buy my books on Amazon or any other source. I don't know where these people get my books, but they are not current issues. My webpage is the only place that sells my books and other materials, and it's the only place you can get the pre-filter, the Chem Rad Oil pre-filter, the only place in this side of the universe you can get that, and also the modular filtration and storage system. I have my own name brand water filters, which are very, very good prices, the best prices on the internet. And hopefully shortly I'll be posting something that I've needed for a long time. It's 10 packs of the filter elements, both the domes and the 7 inches filter elements, my own name brand filter elements. So look for that, the 10 packs of filter elements, something you should look at, a good price on 10 packs. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.